After being briefly described at a meeting of the Gibraltar Scientific Society, it had been sent to the Hunterian Museum in London, where it remained undisturbed but for an occasional light dusting for over half a century. The first formal description of it wasn't written until 1907, and then by a geologist named William Solas, with only a passing competency in anatomy. So instead, the name and credit for the discovery of the first early humans went to the Neander Valley in Germany. Not unfittingly, as it happens, for by uncanny coincidence, Neander in Greek means new man. There in 1856, workmen at another quarry in a cliff face overlooking the Düssel River found some curious-looking bones, which they passed to a local schoolteacher, knowing he had an interest in all things natural. To his great credit, the teacher, Johann Karl Fuhlrott, saw that he had some new type of human, though quite what it was and how special would be matters of dispute for some time. Many people refused to accept that the Neanderthal bones were ancient at all. August Meyer, a professor at the University of Bonn and a man of influence, insisted that the bones were merely those of a Mongolian Cossack soldier who had been wounded while fighting in Germany in 1814 and had crawled into the cave to die. Hearing of this, T.H. Huxley in England dryly observed how remarkable it was that the soldier, though mortally wounded, had climbed 60 feet up a cliff, divested himself of his clothing and personal effects, sealed the cave opening, and buried himself under 2 feet of soil. Another anthropologist, puzzling over the Neanderthal's heavy brow ridge, suggested that it was the result of long-term frowning, arising from a poorly healed forearm fracture. In their eagerness to reject the idea of earlier humans, authorities were often willing to embrace the most singular possibilities. At about the time that Dubois was setting out for Sumatra, a skeleton found in Périgueux was confidently declared to be that of an Eskimo. Quite what an ancient Eskimo was doing in southwest France was never comfortably explained. It was actually an early Cro-Magnon. It was against this background that Dubois began his search for ancient human bones. He did no digging himself, but instead used 50 convicts lent by the Dutch authorities. For a year they worked on Sumatra, then transferred to Java, and there in 1891 Dubois, or rather his team, for Dubois himself seldom visited the sites, found a section of ancient human cranium, now known as the Trinil skull cap. Though only part of a skull, it showed that the owner had had distinctly non-human features, but a much larger brain than any ape. Dubois called it Anthropithecus erectus, later changed for technical reasons to Pithecanthropus erectus, and declared it the missing link between apes and humans. It quickly became popularized as Java Man. Today we know it as Homo erectus. The next year, Dubois' workers found a virtually complete thigh bone that looked surprisingly modern. In fact, many anthropologists think it is modern and has nothing to do with Java Man. If it is an erectus bone, it is unlike any other found since. Nonetheless, Dubois used the thigh bone to deduce, correctly as it turned out, that Pithecanthropus walked upright. He also produced, with nothing but a scrap of cranium and one tooth, a model of the complete skull, which also proved uncannily accurate. In 1895, Dubois returned to Europe expecting a triumphal reception. In fact, he met nearly the opposite reaction. Most scientists disliked both his conclusions and the arrogant manner in which he presented them. The skull cap, they said, was that of an ape, probably a gibbon, and not of any early human. Hoping to bolster his case, in 1897, Dubois allowed a respected anatomist from the University of Strasbourg, Gustav Schwalbe, to make a cast of the skull cap. To Dubois' dismay, Schwalbe thereupon produced a monograph that received far more sympathetic attention than anything Dubois had written, and followed with a lecture tour in which he was celebrated nearly as warmly as if he had dug up the skull himself. Appalled and embittered, Dubois withdrew into an undistinguished position as a professor of geology at the University of Amsterdam, and for the next 2 decades refused to let anyone examine his precious fossils again. He died in 1940, an unhappy man. Meanwhile, and half a world away, in late 1924, Raymond Dart, the Australian-born head of anatomy at the University of the Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, were sent a small but remarkably complete skull of a child with an intact face, a lower jaw, and what is known as an endocast, a natural cast of the brain, from a limestone quarry on the edge of the Kalahari Desert at a dusty spot called Taung. Dart could see at once that the Taung skull was not of a Homo erectus like Dubois' Java man, but from an earlier, more ape-like creature. He placed its age at 2 million years and dubbed it Australopithecus africanus, or Southern Ape Man of Africa. In a report to Nature, Dart called the Taung remains amazingly human and suggested the need for an entirely new family, Homo simiadi, the man apes, to accommodate the find. The authorities were even less favorably disposed to Dart than they had been to Dubois. Nearly everything about his theory, indeed nearly everything about Dart, it appears, annoyed them. First, he had proved himself lamentably presumptuous by conducting the analysis himself, rather than calling on the help of more worldly experts in Europe. Even his chosen name, Australopithecus, showed a lack of scholarly application, combining as it did Greek and Latin roots. Above all, his conclusions flew in the face of accepted wisdom. Humans and apes, it was agreed, had split apart at least 15 million years ago in Asia. If humans had arisen in Africa, why, that would make us Negroid, for goodness sake. It was rather as if someone working today were to announce that he had found the ancestral bones of humans in, say, Missouri. It just didn't fit with what was known. Dart's sole supporter of note was Robert Broome, a Scottish-born physician and paleontologist of considerable intellect and cherishably eccentric nature. It was Broome's habit, for instance, to do his field work naked when the weather was warm, which was often. He was also known for conducting dubious anatomical experiments on his poorer and more tractable patients. When the patients died, which was also often, he would sometimes bury their bodies in his back garden to dig up for study later. Broome was an accomplished paleontologist, and since he was also resident in South Africa, he was able to examine the Taung skull at first hand. He could see at once that it was as important as Dart.